Hey, what's up, Rahapketeers? This is Jess here. Just wanted to let you know, if you are watching one or the other of our Amazing Race International editions, and you want to just listen to one, I'm going to be switching over our coverage to Amazing Race Australia at just about the 1 hour mark, so you can just cut ahead to about halfway through, and that should get you where you need to be if you are in the mood to only listen to Australia. But I hope you will listen to both, because we did have a lot of fun this week, and we got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys think. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to Reality Rehap Ups Amazing Race International Edition. My name is Jessica Leese. I am your Rob Has a Podcast correspondent for all things Amazing Race in the U.S. and beyond. And I was getting some complaints on Twitter that I was talking to a lot of Canadians for covering Amazing Race Canada, and I didn't have any Australians. So this week I have taken some measures to rectify that situation, and so here with me this week, all the way from Tasmania, I have George Wise. George, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm from Tasmania, that tiny state at the bottom of Australia that sometimes even other Australians forget about. I'm a uni student, I'm a Japanese major with a minor in Asian studies, and I'm a big reality fan, particularly of The Amazing Race and Survivor. I've been a fan of The Amazing Race since around about season 10, so I have a fondness for that season as well.
Yeah, that's actually about when I started picking it up religiously as well.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you were saying that because we've got three whole episodes to cover, we should probably start out with Canada and then see how much time we've got to talk about Australia.
So, yeah, definitely.
Okay. So, Canada this week, they nailed it yet again. I think our top story this week has to be one of the longest roadblocks in Amazing Race history.
Yeah, that was crazy. I couldn't imagine how that long that would take.
Yeah, it was such a detail-oriented, nitpicky little task, and the thing that shocked me the most is that it's a sponsored task.
Yeah, well, it made me want to have Mentos, but probably not want to make art with it.
Yeah, probably not, and I'm pretty sure that Pierre and Michelle are never going to eat another Mento as long as they live.
It's crazy that it took them almost more than 7 hours to do that.
Yeah, it's one of those tasks, I think. It was hard for everybody, but I think you often see this on The Amazing Race. People get stuck in one mode, and they get in this mindset where they're not going to be able to do the task, even if it's not objectively a difficult task. Like, we saw this happen, I think this was part of the problem with the infamous hay bales way back in season 3. The one that we always go to when we're talking about someone really having trouble with the roadblock. That's the one we usually go to.
Yeah, you get your mindset in, you think you know what you're doing, but you don't actually do what you should be doing.
Yeah. And you know what they say, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting the same results. And I think you get to a point where you don't know what you can be doing differently.
Yeah, because he probably finished the actual artwork after about 2 hours, and he spent another 6 hours looking for all the mistakes that he had in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll get to some strategies that might have helped some of the other racers as we get through the episode, but we'll just take it right up to the top, and everybody starts out in Bayeux, and they're supposed to do another week in France, I guess. They're going to take a train to Paris and see all of the really obvious Paris sights. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, George, but I never get sick of Paris. They could go there every week, every year if they wanted to.
Yeah, they don't seem to go there as often as you'd think they would, because they went there in the first season of the US version, and have they been there on the US version since then?
I believe they have, at least, like, incidentally. You know, like, they frequently will go to a city for, like, one thing and then go beyond. But they were there in the season you just invoked, season 10.
Yes, I remember now.
There was that whole thing with Charles de Gaulle versus Orly, and...
Yeah, and they even did a similar task for the Detour with the fashion model putting together things.
Yeah, they definitely did. Like, how do you feel about that? I've noticed this, especially now that I'm watching more and more international editions. Like, do you think it's fair to crib an entire task off of another season?
I don't think it's that bad if they don't do it that often, and especially when it's something as long ago as season 10, but it's not something I'd want to see every week, and I'd probably prefer it to not happen, maybe only happen like a small number each season, like 3 maybe at most.
Yeah, I think it was really egregious last season of the US edition where they were pretty much phoning it in the entire time, and it showed. But I think if you do it judiciously, it's not a huge issue, and some of the more memorable tasks, I think you want to see them more often.
Yeah. Like in the Australian version, when season 2, when they went to India and they did a sort of equivalent of the Bollywood task they did in season 20, which I thought was like really difficult but really enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, well, and they also did the task that I think they've done it on Amazing Race Asia and US, where they have to make the dung cakes, and this was kind of a week for handling poop, so we're gonna get into that when we get to Australia. But that's another one that it's kind of tests people's limits in a weird way and gets them into a different aspect of culture that they probably wouldn't have done at home. And so in that regard, I think it's a great task, and I don't mind seeing more than one edition of the show do it.
Yeah.
So we start out, they make everybody leave in the middle of the night, which I thought was kind of stacking the deck in favor of Ryan and Rob a little bit, who were hours and hours behind, but this gives them a chance to catch up. Which, that's not an unusual thing for this show.
I'm amazed that they were so far behind. It shows how lost they got last episode.
Yeah, well, they were all over the place. They have not had the greatest luck in terms of navigation this season, and it's...
At least we got the nice tour of Normandy.
Yeah, it added some local color, and I think I had a couple of people mention on Twitter this past week that one of the reasons we don't often see it when people get lost is that there's not much interesting about them just yelling at each other and trying to figure out where they're at. But in the case of Ryan and Rob, it was an opportunity for us to get a little extra scenery.
Yeah, that's true.
And they handled it very well.
Yeah, they were very upbeat about it. Normally when you get that kind of team getting lost, they start yelling at each other and imploding, but they handled it really well.
Yeah, I think other teams may not have done so well. I'm very disappointed that we've already lost Rex and Bob, because if they'd gotten lost in France, it would have been epic.
Yeah, so it would have gone to another screaming match like they were as they rode down the river.
Yeah, and it would have been like twice as amazing, I think. Or they might have just gotten on a plane and gone home, which... Yeah. So, I liked this. There was a great little moment when Pierre and Michelle get to the train station. Megan and Natalie are hiding, and they jump out and scare them. I thought that was hilarious. And you don't see a lot of that kind of joking around, especially when it comes to Pierre and Michelle, who are such robots when it comes to this stuff.
Yes, it's nice seeing some people managing to get some sort of emotion out of them. It did kind of remind me of the hippies from season 9 doing it, but I know that you're not a fan of them.
Well, I don't have a problem with them per se, but yeah, it was like that, maybe a little more organic.
Yeah.
And speaking of hippies, Mickey and Pete added a new adjective to their lexicon this week. They didn't say they were stoked to still be in the race, they were jazzed. And they also used the expression "no foolsies," which I love.
I have never heard of either of those.
I've heard jazzed. I've never heard "no foolsies." That one might be a Mickey and Pete original.
Yeah, I might have to start using that one.
Yeah, I mean, who says television isn't educational?
Definitely.
One thing I thought was really hilarious was
when they got to the sign-up board to get on the trains, Suki and Jinder wrote their full name on the sign-up board in case there was some other Suki and Jinder that might make things confusing.
Yeah, that was... I don't quite understand that.
Well, there's not much that anybody understands about them. Like, what's your take on Suki and Jinder?
To be honest, I think people are a bit hard on them. They're not terrible races. They're just very manic and energetic, and it can drive other people up the wall, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is a sort of... There's a template for that kind of team. That they're not terrible racers, but their personality kind of gets in the way of being able to independently assess what kind of racers they are.
Yeah, sort of like the 20s.
Exactly.
The 20s are really good racers. Well, maybe not on the last season, but they very strategic, and because of how loud they are and how much they annoy some of the other teams, it gets in the way of some people's ability to see how good they are at racing.
Yeah. I'd almost even maybe put Charlotte and Mirna in this category.
Yeah, I was also... I was trying to think of teams that the 20s were like, and Charlotte and Mirna really are one of the other teams like that. That really... They're very divisive, but they're huge fan favorites with certain people as well.
Yeah. And it definitely, it makes for... Even if it's not maybe the team that you'd want to be trapped in an elevator with, teams like this are always kind of... Like, you remember them years after they were on television.
Yeah.
And I think Suki and Jinder are definitely, like, if Canada lasts long enough to get an All-Stars, I would be shocked if these guys weren't on it.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to see them again.
Yeah. So, we're in the train station, and we see kind of one of the crucial defining moments of this episode, where we have both of the Francophone teams are chatting with each other, and the twins make this pact with Alain and Audre that they are not going to U-turn each other, because I guess the Quebecois have to stick together. And as we learn, Pierre and Michelle really don't have much of a sense of what their word means.
No, I don't quite understand why Elaine and Audrey suddenly decided to try and get an alliance with Pierre and Michelle, other than the same language, but I still don't think that's much of a reason to form an alliance.
Yeah, and especially as untrusting as the twins are, I think it almost backfired on them that they started talking to the twins. And I think their comment was, she's never talked to us before, why is she talking to us now?
Yeah, you shouldn't try and start an alliance after ignoring a team for the whole race. It's generally going to make them a little bit suspicious of you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I liked the Pierre's assessment of the situation that they don't believe that Alain and Audrey are trustful. There's another new word for your vocabulary. Although I was kind of shocked that they would have that conversation and then turn right around and say, this is the team we're going to U-turn. I'm not surprised that karma came for the twins, put it that way.
No, I'm not surprised about that either, but it is strange that you'd agree to something when you definitely plan to U-turn this particular team. It's definitely going to get some animosity, not just from that team, but potentially from other teams as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very inelegant strategy, I think. Like, I think a better strategist is just going to not... They're going to find a way to not have to make those arrangements.
Yeah, like, Natalie and Megan made that deal with Pierre and Michelle, and they haven't really been against any of the other teams, so they haven't really gained sort of hatred that makes other teams want to U-turn them.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. Natalie and Megan really haven't played into any of the drama. Like, they don't create their own, they don't get involved with other people's. Which is probably why they're winning so many legs.
Yeah, 6 legs at this point.
Yeah, they're in the running to tie the record.
Yeah, and I was looking at sort of the stats for, like, placement averages. At the moment, if you compared them to American teams, the only team that's currently better than them is Eric and Jeremy from Season 9.
Yeah, and I think they definitely have the potential to surpass Eric and Jeremy.
Yeah.
I'm still going with them. I don't see a universe in which the Hockey Girls do not win this entire thing.
Yeah, the other teams, there are some strong other teams, but none of them are on the level of the Hockey Girls.
Yeah, it's like there's no competition out there. Although I do wonder what would happen if we did our hypothetical Amazing Race Commonwealth All-Stars and we stuck Megan and Natalie in a race with John and Murray.
You know, I still think Natalie and Megan would come on top.
Yeah.
John and Murray are a bit too... They're too... not strategic, but they try to over-strategize, and I feel as if that's going to catch up with them eventually.
Yeah, it's actually... If John and Murray have an analog in the Amazing Race Canada, it's got to be Pierre and Michelle.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, once everybody's on the train, they're on their way to Paris, Mickey points out he's never been on a train before, which boggles my mind.
Well, I hadn't been on a train until I was quite, well, not quite old, but, like, older than I imagine Americans would be when catching a train, because in Tasmania we don't have trains, and I had to go to the main... The mainland is what Tasmanians called the main part of Australia.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to go on one until I went there. So I can sort of relate about that.
Yeah, I mean, you can drive the entire, like, all around Tasmania in, like, a day or two, can't you?
Yeah, and I've done that. But it's not exactly the most interesting thing, but the scenery's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, now, Tasmanian Devil, I have to ask, is that really... I have heard that that's really an animal. Is that a myth or an animal?
No, it's really an animal. It's a little feral black and white thing, and you probably don't want to get in the same area with one because they'll gnaw your leg off.
Yeah, so it's not just a clever name, then?
No, it's not just a clever name.
Yeah, I think this came up in one of our earlier podcasts, like when Rob and I were recapping an episode, I think it came up, and I don't think Rob believed me that it was an actual animal, so I'm glad to have that confirmation from an actual Tasmanian.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to France and back to Canada. The first clue tells everybody they have to go to the Place du Canada, and apparently it's pretty close by. Everybody probably could have walked it, but Mickey and Pete hit possibly the worst bad cab luck I've ever seen on any edition of this show.
Yeah, going 2 hours out of your way, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it was... You could tell they were in trouble when they got out to ask directions from someone, and the first comment out of the bystander's mouth was, "Oh, that's in Paris."
How far out of Paris would they have to have been for someone to say that?
I don't even know. I assumed they were still, like, in the suburbs, but I think they were pretty fairly far out of things by that point. It was weird to me that the first place the driver went in his head was this random tiny street in the suburbs, which was called Place de Canada. You always have to keep your article straight in French. It was very similar to last season of Amazing Race US in Rome, with John and Jessica's cab driver confusing John Keats's home with John Keats Street and taking them to the complete opposite end of Rome, and it could have had similar game-ending ramifications for Pete and Mickey, but thankfully didn't, although they are 100 euros poorer for this thing.
Mickey and Pete were really... Well, they weren't crazy positive about it, but they kept a positive attitude about it, and I think that helped them throughout the rest of the leg.
Yeah, I wonder what it would take to really set them off. I'm kind of thinking that when you're that laid back, you pretty much have to be in the midst of, like, hostage situation to lose your cool.
Yeah. One other thing around about this point was when Suki and Jinder were in a cab going to the same place, Suki decided to tell the cab driver to say rapido, which is an Amazing Race favorite, but I don't think it's appropriate for France.
No, and they're so close. Like, you could just say rapide, couldn't you? I don't know. I don't speak French, but...
No, I don't know much about French either.
Yeah, but I do know enough about French not to speak Spanish to a French cab driver. So there is that.
Yeah.
So Alain and André are enjoying the city of love, and this is kind of foreshadowing, but they seem like they're among the most affectionate Amazing Race couples that I've ever seen. Like, they're really into each other.
Yeah, it's a really sweet couple, and I'm happy about what happened eventually.
Yeah, I am as well. And not a huge surprise, but it was, like, they were really loving up on each other this entire episode, almost to an irritating extent, but not quite.
Well, it's the city of love. You can forgive them a little bit.
That's true. Paris is an amazing city. So we get to the detour, and I have in my notes that when he speaks French, John Montgomery is so much less of a douche than Alex Trebek. And he presents haute couture or plat du jour. And in this detour, you get to either find a bunch of food items in cafes and purchase the food and bring it to the patrons, which I thought was a little too similar to the episode in Victoria where they had to memorize the tea menu.
Yeah, it was just like they added one more step, which was running around and finding the restaurants, but the final part was exactly the same, pretty much, except in a different language.
Yeah, I didn't actually think either one of these detours seemed all that difficult, and they weren't very exacting with it.
Well, maybe I'm just not familiar with it, so I would have thought the dressmaking was harder, but I do agree that it didn't look like they were being asked to be that specific with how well they were making the dresses.
Yeah, it looked like it was more... Like, you have judges that will get you on every tiny technicality, and you have... Then you have judges that are like, oh, you did the task, okay, you can go. And I think it probably varies according to how long they think the other side of the detour is going to take.
Yeah, like, in Season 10, the judge for the dressmaking detour was much stricter. That, like, one of the other teams referred to her as the Gestapo of fashion or something.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a rough one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these food items, definitely not as hard to remember as the ones when they were serving the tea. And I don't know exactly how much space... Did you catch how much space they had to run around in? Like, was it three blocks, or was it, like, one street? I couldn't tell.
No, I didn't catch that, but I can't imagine it's... It seemed big, but not too big to be problematic.
Yeah, it was probably about the same as the task in Macau, where they had to run around in all the streets. But, anyway, they were not... They were not particularly exact about pronunciation on this either, because there were a couple of teams that did not know how to pronounce charcuterie.
Yeah, Suki's method was very strange, I'll say.
Yeah, and I guess you have to have the Suki and Jinder moment where they do something ridiculous every week, and Suki spilling the coffee all over the place was... That might be their, you know, wacky moment. I feel like they should have their own sound effect.
Well, at least they noticed before they went to the customers that they had to give the food items to, unlike Elaine and Audrey who do it later.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really... You have to give Suki and Jinder credit for this. They are very observant, and if they screw up on something, they're going to figure it out before it kills them.
Yeah, they're much more observant than you'd expect, given their level of energy.
Yeah. What they do works for them. And that's kind of... I started out the beginning of the season, and I didn't think I was going to enjoy them at all. But they have definitely grown on me. And I guess it's the problem with... Actually, with both of these seasons, there's nobody left that I really want to see eliminated, because everybody contributes something.
I disagree about the Australian version, but we'll get to that after.
We'll definitely get to that. That is a controversial opinion, I realize. So, we get a little moment of kind of more inelegant strategy where Suki and Jinder run into Ryan and Rob during the food task, and they tell them that they have not found anything. And this is completely inexplicable because their hands are full of bags of food.
Yeah, they could have at least just said, we're in a race, we don't want to tell you, instead of lying outright when the lie can be found out, like, just by looking at them.
is also kind of ironic that Suki and Jinder, who have been explicitly asking everyone everywhere for help on everything, that they're not going to provide some help back.
Yeah, it was also weird how they sort of... It was sort of implied on the show that this... Robin Ryan asking for help was what set Suki and Jinder to U-turn them later.
Yeah, and I don't believe that's the case. I think what Suki and Jinder did was a very smart use of a U-turn. When you consider what they must have known about what was going on with the race. They knew what teams are behind them, and you don't want to waste your U-turn, as people have already done this season, by U-turning someone who's in front of you.
Yeah. Also, it's also smart because Rob and Ryan do have that speed bump to deal with, so it also pushes them further behind, so you probably... Well, they do, but they probably wouldn't have had to deal with them again.
Yeah. Yeah, if everybody had kind of done the tasks in the amount of time that everybody thought they were going to do them, I think Ryan and Rob would definitely have been out of it. But you had two kind of wrenches thrown into that plan. You had, number one, Mickey and Pete taking a two-hour detour, and number two, Pierre and Michelle being Pierre and Michelle. But yeah, Mickey and Pete do show up towards the end of this task, and I don't know how they had enough money left to do the food, because they were supposed to use their cards to buy all the food, and they just wasted, like, two-thirds of their money for the leg. So
yeah, did you catch how much money they had at the start of the leg?
Yeah, 150 euros, I think.
Oh, okay, so, yeah, they wouldn't have had much left at all.
Yeah, unless... They probably get to keep their money. I've heard varying accounts on whether or not racers get to keep the money that they have left over from the previous leg. Like, in early seasons, they were pretty upfront that everybody did. But then I've heard some racers from more recent seasons say that they have to give up all the money at the end of the leg. So, I am unclear. Given that it's sort of a debit card situation, I'm gonna say they probably get to accumulate money over time.
Yeah, I assume that would be the case as well. I'm confused about that in the US version as well, because, like, there are still some legs where they get, like, $0 or $1, and I can't imagine they'd manage to get a whole leg done on that little money.
Yeah, well, they usually don't give people money if they have to drive themselves. I think the money is supposed to mostly cover cab fare.
Yeah, that's true.
So, on the legs where they don't get any money, I think... It's just more because they're not supposed to have to buy anything. So Shane Gallagher pointed out on Twitter he had a random inappropriate comment that he found, and we love the out-of-context comments. It's almost like Jeff Probst is here with us. When they were looking for the cafe, apparently Jinder said, "We are so close, it's like right in front of our face coming."
I did not catch that one.
I didn't either. I mean, that's hilarious, but there was a lot going on, so I'm going to take Shane's word for it. That's pretty awesome. Good out of context.
He's much more noticeable than I am.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing. I got a record number of tweets from people this episode, and I'm so thankful for it, because people notice tiny stuff that I am not going to get while I'm watching and taking notes. Like, even if I have a chance to watch it twice, which some weeks I do, this week I didn't. I'm really thankful for people pointing out things that I need to go back and take note of. And this is not necessarily one of those things, but there are other things like that that happened.
Yeah, this was the first time I've ever taken notes while watching an episode, and it's quite difficult to actually do and keep track of the episode at the same time.
Yeah, you never know what's going to come back, what's going to be the most important thing.
Or you might miss something while you're writing something down that's just visual.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I tend to have, like, one window open and the text window next to it, but everybody's mileage varies on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Which one of these detours looked harder to you?
Because it's something I'm not familiar with, I would have said the dressmaking, because running around and remembering three names, it seems quite easy to me. The main problem being keeping your coffee from falling down.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed pretty clear-cut to me as well, and I think those are some of the best U-turns, the one where everybody does the same task because they know the other one's harder, and this leads us right up to the U-turn. Natalie and Megan are smart and know that they don't have to U-turn anybody, so they don't.
One thing I noticed when Natalie and Megan ran up to the U-turn board is they played the cowboy theme.
Yeah, they did.
I'm sick of that theme.
Yeah. There are some music cues that I absolutely love. Like, I love the little horns that goes da 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 da. That one's fantastic. And I like the kind of triumphant strings that come in, and I like the gong when somebody does something stupid. But, yeah, Cowboys theme, I could do without forever.
Well, hopefully the US version doesn't feel the need to use that anymore now that the Cowboys have been on for a third time.
Yeah, or maybe the new twist is the Cowboys are going to be on every other season. Who knows?
Oh, God.
But I guess with that, between that and Sweet Georgia Brown, I'm going to say that the Cowboys theme is the lesser of two evils.
Sweet Georgia Brown makes even less sense to me in these international versions.
Yeah, well, it makes no sense to anybody that's never seen the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah, I didn't even know that it was a thing until, like, I heard you guys point it out often enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and apparently in some countries they don't even use that, so that even... I don't know. I guess if you were watching in Canada, you didn't know what we were talking about. So, then the twins arrive at the U-turn, and they do the unthinkably dumb thing, and they U-turn Alain and Audrey. And this strategically made absolutely no sense.
No, I didn't quite understand it either. They thought they were far enough ahead, and it's just creating unnecessary animosity with other teams.
Yeah, plus, at that point, you're that far ahead, you shouldn't feel like you're in danger, and I think that's a better use of a U-turn, is if you think that you might be eliminated if you don't use it. And that's, I think, it's part of the reasoning behind Suki and Jinder's decision to U-turn Ryan and Rob, because they didn't necessarily know who else was behind them at that point, and they knew that Ryan and Rob had the speed bump, and that would basically just give them another cushion to make sure that they're not going to be eliminated, given that they're at the back of the pack.
Yeah, I'm sure Pierre and Michelle would not appreciate being called less strategical than Suki and Jinder.
Well, you know, when people are saying that you're less strategical than Suki and Jinder, you need to re-examine your life choices.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, everybody kind of forgets about Mickey and Pete, who, I don't know, I think maybe the people in back assumed they were up in front, and the people in front knew that they weren't up front with them. But everybody forgets about them, they're pretty stoked about that. But Alain and Andre are understandably quite annoyed that they have been U-turned. But I thought, like, they seem to be going into this season, I thought they were going to be a really abrasive team that kind of overreacts to things, but they seem to take this pretty much in stride. There was a little sniping, a little yelling, but, you know, they got it done.
Yeah, they didn't complain all that much. They were angry at Pierre and Michelle, but they weren't fine with being U-turned, but they got it done.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, Canada is trying to cast people that are going to be very polarizing, and even the ones that sort of do a couple of villainy things, they're still not quite getting there.
No, Pierre and Michelle, I'd argue, would probably be the most villainous team this season, and they're still not that dislikable.
Yeah, no, they're still very charming, despite their kind of strategic mastermind overthinking things.
Yeah, they have that amusing French robot charm.
Yeah, the old amusing French robot charm. Yeah, so I got a lot of complaints about the speed bump. Apparently, this seemed like it was on the hard side as far as speed bumps go. Survivor Twerks on Twitter pointed out that she doesn't think there's actually ever been a harder one. What's your sense of that?
That's an interesting one. I didn't really think about comparing it to other speed bumps, but it was quite difficult. I can't imagine trying to learn a tune. Well, they've played the accordion on season 17, but this is a speed bump. Yeah, it's quite hard to learn an instrument that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the song that they learned is one that I learned, like, the first 2 months of taking piano lessons when I was, like, 5. So I know that it's not one that requires a whole range of notes. Like, you can probably put your hand in one place and hit all the notes you need. So there was that. There's also the fact that the judge was not very particular. I'm pretty sure that they were not really playing in unison.
Like, no, I didn't get that sense of.
It seemed like Ryan had it and Rob was just kind of playing along. But it worked. And it certainly, I would say, definitely, I've never seen anybody actually have trouble with a speed bump to the point that it necessarily put them in danger when they wouldn't have been otherwise. And this is not an exception on that front.
Yeah, the speed bump was there, but the roadblock was really hard, so everyone really had a chance to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was kind of one of the ultimate fake-out questions on a roadblock. Who likes candies? And they could have put in parentheses, you probably won't like them very much after you're done.
No, I can't imagine being that big a fan of Mentos, having used that many.
I wonder if anybody was eating them while they were making the art.
I would have been.
Oh yeah, me too. Now, I had this toy when I was a kid. It was called the Light Bright. Have you seen these things? It's like a pegboard, and you have these little light bulbs that you stick in it, and then you can plug it in, and it lights up with the art that you've made. And that's what this looked like to me. It was like a giant Light Bright made of Mentos.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen one in person, but I know about them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm also dating myself incredibly, because I think they're probably, like, too many tiny parts for children these days. So, this test, this is definitely... I asked people to kind of tweet at me what they think are some of the worst roadblocks of all time. And we got a lot of eating challenge answers, and of course we got the hay bales. But where do you think this stacks up on worst Amazing Race roadblocks of all time?
I think it's up there, but I don't think it's the hardest. I think it can be more difficult if you let yourself think it's hard, but there are definitely harder ones. This isn't particularly strenuous physically. You're just looking at something and it can get frustrating, but you should be able to figure it out.
Yeah. So, Natalie got it on the second try. It took her, like, maybe an hour and a half.
Yeah, she was easily the fastest person to complete this roadblock.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's not surprising considering how the hockey girls have done so far. It's kind of ironic that the only thing they've really had a lot of trouble with was hockey.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's very weird. Like, maybe they just kind of decided to compensate for all of their possible perceived weaknesses and they studied absolutely everything but hockey. That's
yeah,
my theory.
They're rusted over.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. So... But this task was incredibly tedious, and there's not really a way to, you know, do anything other than brute force your way through it. Like, people had different methods of what order they were putting the candies in, but it really just came down to having a really good eye for detail. And I thought that Audrey and Pete had the best idea here. Like, she couldn't see her own mistakes, but she could see what Pete was doing wrong, so she says to him, "Pete, if you point out something that I did wrong, I will tell you what you did wrong." And I think it gives her the upper hand, and it also, it gets them both out of there ahead of other people that are still at the roadblock.
Yeah, I thought that was a good strategy. The idea of working together with someone else and looking at their piece of work is probably a good idea, because you're not constantly looking at your own and getting in your own head about it, so you're looking at something fresh that's not your own.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely helped to have another pair of eyes in that regard, and I thought there are a lot of roadblocks where it does not make a lot of sense to team up, and there are a lot of situations where even if you did team up, it wouldn't necessarily make sense to do it. But in that event, I think it was absolutely the right decision to make, and it helped them both out.
Yeah, it was mutually beneficial.
Yeah. So over at, I don't know, what do you want to call this? Like, there's always the area where the people that are not doing the roadblock hang out. Like, it's like a little penalty box or something where they just have to stand on the sidelines and they have to observe. And so there's a lot of interesting confrontations that happened, which always happens when there's a U-turn, but people are especially irritated.
Yeah, I don't know, I just call it the bench. But it's awkward when you have this long period of time with people that you're angry with, and you can only say so much before it gets tedious.
Yeah. Yeah, and they definitely didn't have 8 hours worth of arguing to do.
No, definitely not.
But understandably, Elaine is not happy with the twins. And the twins had kind of hoped that they'd be out of there well before Audrey and Elaine even finished their other half of the detour, but that unfortunately was not the case. And I think Suki and Jinder had the same problem, because here Ryan and Rob roll in, and they've done their other half of the detour, and they've done their speed bump, and now everybody is kind of on a level playing field.
Yeah, in the detour, Ryan had a very vicious comment about pinning the dress to Suki's skin. That was a bit weird.
That was a little dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they have a dark streak, Ryan and Rob do. Like, you think of them as being kind of fun-loving, but I think they can be pretty snarky.
Well, I think they try and keep it to themselves mostly. Like, they didn't say that to Suki's face, and they weren't happy with them, but they were probably a bit nicer than Elaine and Audrey were.
Yeah, it seems like they were mostly over it by the time they got done. And, you know, it didn't knock them out of the race. So everybody's going to end up being equalized anyway, because we've got an international flight in the next leg.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did enjoy Pierre and Jinder kind of having this bonding moment about being villains. That was pretty fun.
Well, it's unfortunate that he won't have his villain friend anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the secret club is already busted up. Yeah. So 7 hours and 52 minutes. That's pretty crazy.
I just can't imagine looking at something for that long and not being able to pick all of the mistakes within that period of time.
Yeah, I mean, they said there were 1,000 Mentos on there, but still, you have to be able to take it. Like, it looked like there were sections of it. Like, you could take it, like, one little blob at a time.
Yeah, you can focus on one section, make sure that's all correct, go to the next section, and even if you do it that way, and even if it's time-consuming, I don't see how it can take almost 8 hours.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. We got a great question on Twitter. Carrie wanted to know, regarding the Mentos art, how does the checker know if just one Mento is the wrong color? That looks like it would be really hard to spot. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I feel as if there'd be more than one judge so they can get the judging done quicker, but we only saw one of them.
Yeah, I think what usually happens with this, racers have told us in podcasts that they have producers off screen, and sometimes the judge takes an active role in determining whether someone's right or wrong, but other times it's just the producers are kind of confer and tell them whether to give them the clue or not. So I have to imagine there was a committee behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So John Johnston wanted to know how we think it stacks up to the dinosaur assembling in season 18.
I would probably say the dinosaur assembly was harder, because it's a physical task. You've got to run back and forth between the model. You don't have it, like, right in front of you. And also, if you make a mistake, it's much harder to, like, undo it and then start again.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It didn't seem to take people 8 hours, but it was definitely more exhausting and more frustrating. Like, nobody cried over the Mentos.
No one cried over the Mentos.
Michelle was there for quite a while. I think he wanted to cry, but, you know, he kept it together until after the race.
Yeah, and then Pierre offered him that hug right at the end, so that's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice that there weren't any hard feelings about that, because I have to think maybe the toughest thing about going on the race would be going on with your partner and then sitting there on the non-roadblock bench and watching your partner not be able to do something and you having absolutely no power to change that. That seems like that must be the most frustrating thing you have to go through.
Yeah, because you can't you can say things, but you can't help their how much they feel like they're probably failing. Like they understand that they're letting you down, but you want to tell them that that's not the case.
Yeah. And I think it's really a sign of how classy people are, how they respond to the situation. And I have to give the twins this. They were classy up until the end. Like, they were not great strategists, and they did some things that pissed people off for no reason, but they were really classy to each other.
Yeah, they have a really good bond and brotherhood.
Yeah. And they're also, I think they were much more capable than most of the twins that we have seen on the race.
Yeah, twins tend not to have a very good run on the race.
Yeah, I mean, my theory on that is that they're just too similar, and you need somebody whose differences, like, you can kind of balance each other out. And that's why we see so many, like, couples win, because you have somebody that's very physically strong, somebody who's smart. But with twins, you probably went to the same schools and played the same sports, and you're the same height and weight. It's a handicap.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. So, we have our list. I don't have it in a top 10 format, but I wanted to mention some of the worst Amazing Race tasks of all time that people came up with. And Rouleauville came up with my all-time favorite episode of Amazing Race. It was the double leg in Hungary in season 6. And possibly one of the worst roadblocks of all time involved having to eat a giant bowl of spicy soup. And Rouleauville's assessment, tough for competitors, hard to watch for the audience, annoying music, fighting, vomiting, all in one.
Yeah, especially since Freddie from Freddie and Kendra, as much as people hate Kendra, Freddie threw up into his bowl, so he had to eat that part again.
Yeah, and Kendra's just sitting in the sidelines crying over this. I invoke the vomit eating way more often than I should as an Amazing Race podcaster. But eating challenges kind of tended to be things that people bring up, because Amazing Race eating challenges tend to be not just one gross thing, but many gross things. So you had, like, Michael Harmstone points out the caviar in season 5, because nobody eats 2 pounds of caviar unless you're doing an Amazing Race challenge.
And yeah. It's just so weird that they make them do things that normal people wouldn't do.
Yeah, but, you know, it's part of the cultural immersion experience, I guess, although nobody in Russia eats 2 pounds of caviar either. And people pointed out, there's also the infamous meat block from season 7.
Yeah, 4 pounds of, what kind of meat was it again?
Oh, it was a variety of things, and, you know, this will segue quite nicely into when we talk about Amazing Race Australia, because there were, I think you had to eat a kidney and a salivary gland, and then there was, like, a normal piece of steak, and you had a sausage. It was just kind of, you didn't know whether to get the gross stuff first or to eat the normal stuff and then go for the gross stuff. And Boston Rob then decided he's not going to do any of this because he and his weak stomach can't handle it, and he just convinces everybody else to quit. So, in that sense, I was kind of surprised nobody even entertained the notion of quitting the Mento Challenge.
Yeah, it's probably because it's something that you feel like it's something you can just correct and then you're done, as opposed to something that you think you're never going to get done.
Yeah. Yeah. But I still can't fathom, like, sitting there for 8 hours. That's a little bit insane. The sandcastles from season 22 are up there. Jeff Adolfson pointed that out. And composer Mark C. pointed out one that is a very nice segue into the next portion of our Amazing Race Canada recap. He points out that another season 6 favorite, the love locks. And I don't know if you remember this. I don't even remember where they were, but they had, like, thousands of locks and one key.
Yeah, I think it was China.
Yeah, I wanted to say it was China. It's somewhere in Southeast Asia. And it was, if you broke your key, you had to go get a different one. And it was thousands and thousands of little tiny locks. I think that one might actually have been worse than the Mentos.
It's It's very much the definition of insanity.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, a little shout out to that, perhaps. Our pit stop is the Pont de la Chevêché, which is the lock bridge. And did you know about this before, George? Have you seen this anywhere?
No, I did not know about the one in France. We had the similar one in Russia a few seasons back.
Yeah. Yeah, it's apparently this is a huge landmark in Paris, and I've been there, I've seen it, and we had a similar, people were trying to do something similar to the Brooklyn Bridge here in New York, and there have been multiple news reports where the city's port authority gets on the horn to the city and says, you guys, please don't put any more locks on the bridge, we're going to clip them off, because the weight of the locks is actually causing extra strain on the bridge and could actually damage it. So, you know, we're no fun. We're not allowed to have locks on our bridges.
How poorly made is the bridge that it can't suspend a couple of locks?
Well, it can't suspend a couple. A couple probably don't make make much of a difference, but a couple thousand?
Yeah.
You know, I believe this lock bridge has actually sustained some damage because there is quite a bit of extra weight on it.
I guess it does build up.
Yeah. I think it's just something. If a couple people do it, that's one thing, but you don't want to encourage everyone to do it because that's kind of a thing in New York. If there's something that's a little bit cool, there's going to be 1,000 people doing it tomorrow, and it's not going to be quite so cool anymore.
Yeah.
But this is something they encourage in Paris, and I hit a moment at this pit stop where my theory about the final task has been totally blown to smithereens by this particular pit stop greeter.
I remember this, and I wasn't thinking about it when I saw this mime.
Yeah, of course. I was listening to everybody have this beautiful line of poetry that they spouted about their own location, and then we get a mime. So I guess that's not what the final task is going to be.
It could be the thing that the mime had on his piece of cardboard.
Oh, did he have a piece of cardboard?
I think he had a piece of cardboard and it said something like, maybe it was just welcome to Paris.
Yeah, well, if he had something on the cardboard, then I guess the theory still stands.
I just, going on to Alain and Audrey's proposal, like, it's nice that it's in Paris, it's nice that it's on the show, but you'll forever remember the fact that a mime watched it.
Yeah, that's a little uncomfortable. You don't want to, like, it's almost like every memory of the event is going to have that mime in the background now. And if it didn't before, now that we've brought it up.
Yeah, they're just going to, that's the thing that's going to stick out, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. So in general, this was pretty adorable, wasn't it? Like, mime aside.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for these kind of things. I really liked it when Chad proposed to Stephanie and Oman in season 17 as well. So I like it when teams make this step on the race.
Yeah. And actually, the lock challenge, immediately after the lock challenge, I believe was when Aaron proposed to Hayden on the mat as they were getting eliminated.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, they're not the most memorable of teams. Like, they didn't get asked back for All-Stars.
Yeah, that's true.
But she had basically rage quit the lock task, and they were out, and he did something to make her feel better, and I think it probably worked.
Yeah. Talking about locks, I think Audrey mentioned this on her Twitter, that the producers gave her and Elaine a lock to put on the bridge.
Yeah, that's actually, it's in a bonus scene on the website.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I thought it was really interesting that John said they should go out and enjoy the city. I'm like, wait a minute, they're supposed to be sequestered. They're just going to let them go have a date?
Do we know Canadian teams get sequestered?
Oh, we don't. I think they do. I'm going to have to ask this. I've got some racer guests hopefully coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to ask them about this, but I'm pretty sure like they all at least have to stay in one spot. I know this is kind of generally across the board. Once you check in at the pit stop, you're supposed to go, like, wait in your area. Like, if it's a hotel, you stay in the hotel, and if it's a campground, like, you don't leave the area. But And I've never seen a host tell people to go out and have fun in the city. Like, that's never happened.
No, I don't think they promote random teams walking around the city.
Yeah, like, go sightsee. Sure, because who knows? Like, the next morning you might get off to start the race and you might be directed to go somewhere you saw while you were out wandering around in the city.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so I think that's one reason. Also, you know, you don't want to have your racers out in public as, you know, as much as you can control that. You don't want that because you have, I don't know how much you know about the spoiler community, George, but...
Yeah, I know about these not crazy, but like how obsessed they are about finding these teams as they travel around the world.
Yeah, I wouldn't say crazy. I would say dedicated is definitely an accurate...
Yeah, that's a much better word.
Yeah, so... I think if John tells people to go out and sightsee, the very first person they're going to run into is whoever is covering Paris for the Reality Fan Forum.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another reason they kind of tend to sequester them. But maybe you get engaged, it's a special occasion, go put a lock on your bridge, go have a glass of champagne. I think that's forgivable.
Yeah, they might have given them the opportunity to go to a nice restaurant, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what they feed them at pit stops, but I'm sure whatever you get in any restaurant in Paris is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Phil Gourlay, my friend and occasional co-host on this very show, says he thinks it's the best proposal we've ever seen in Amazing Race history. Would you agree with that?
Paris is a great location to do it. Even though I'm not the biggest fan of Chad and Stephanie, I think the idea of doing it at sunrise on the shores in Oman was a really nice place to do it.
Yeah, and I think with Chad and Stephanie, that was something very specific to them. Whereas if you propose to someone on the Amazing Race, Matt, it's tied up with you being on the Amazing Race. Like, Chad and Stephanie could have had a romantic moment at sunrise on the beach anywhere, and they happened to be in Oman when it happened. So I think it was less Amazing Racey in that regard.
Yeah.
But I think any time that happens, it's really lovely and amazing. I don't want to encourage it to happen every single time.
No, don't do it if you don't mean it.
Yeah, seriously. But you know what really shocked me was in season 23, I was absolutely 100% certain that we were going to see Jason propose to Amy. If not on the final mat, then at the finale party. And it didn't happen until about a week ago. And he did it at Disney World in front of Cinderella's castle. And they are now engaged. So we wish them all the best.
Yes. Congratulations to Jason and Amy.
Yes. But if ever a team was going to get engaged on an Amazing Race, Matt, I thought it was going to be them. But regardless, we're happy for everybody that stays together after the Amazing Race, because a lot of people don't.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah. So... Natalie and Megan win the leg. Suki and Jinder show up. Mickey and Pete in third. Elaine and Audre and a proposal in fourth place. And Ryan and Rob survive their two detours and a speed bump. And the twins check in last, and they are eliminated because karma is a bitch.
Very much so. It's amusing to see French speakers being eliminated in France.
Yeah, it's almost as satisfying as, like, in the family edition, the Schroeder family getting eliminated in their own hometown.
That's still crazy to me.
Yeah. I get some schadenfreude over it. I gotta be honest.
I will say about the family edition, I don't think it's as bad as you say it is.
I think it's just, I don't like the formula to get messed with.
Yeah. The family edition is still quite interesting to me in the same way The Amazing Race Canada is, because I don't know much about the US, so it gives me the opportunity to see all these parts of America that they don't normally show on The Amazing Race.
Yeah, I think it was poorly timed. It was not the time to mix things up, because they were coming off their highest rated season ever, and they just torpedoed it by taking out the world travel aspect. And I think it could have worked in another... I think it could have worked at another point. Like, they held off a few more seasons and then tried to roll it out. I think it would have been much better for the franchise. But it was just
originally,
kind It was poor timing all around.
Originally, it was going to be an All-Stars season, wasn't it?
I think so, but I think they really... I think waiting a little bit longer for that paid off, absolutely.
Yeah. The original All-Stars is probably one of my favorite seasons of the show.
Yeah, definitely mine as well. I think everybody... I mean, apart from the winners, everybody came off better than they did in their original season.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... Actually, Phil Gourlay asks something relevant to All-Stars. He said, who did karma bite more, Pierre and Michelle or Danny and Oswald, when they yielded and lost?
I like Danny and Oswald. I'd say Pierre and Michelle, but that's because I'd say they're a bit... It's hard to say karma bites people in the ass when they're... generally, well, Pierre and Michelle aren't not nice people, but they're a little bit more distant in terms of how they approach the race.
Yeah, it was certainly, I think, more satisfying to see them go. Like, Danny and Oswald, I was genuinely sad. But Pierre and Michelle, it's like, yeah, that's what you get.
Yeah.
And my final thought on this week's episode is I'm surprised that nobody has yet made a supercut of Michelle building that Mentos sculpture with the Mentos theme song playing in the background.
What is the Mentos theme song? We don't have that here.
Oh, you don't have the Mentos theme song. Yeah, they had, I would say, probably from the late 90s to about 2003, 2004, there was a Mentos ad, and it was ubiquitous in the United States, and I think probably several other countries, but... I will provide a link to this in the either in the notes for the show or in the comments on the website, because everyone should see the Mentos theme song, and they would always have like somebody in a complex situation that they needed to get out of. Like, there was a guy that couldn't get across the street because the crosswalk is being blocked, so he gets in a guy's car and goes through it and goes to the other side, and it's because he's eating Mentos that he thinks outside the box, I guess.
And well, I have something to look forward to.
Yes, and the slogan at the end was Mentos, the fresh maker.
I remember that. I don't remember the theme song.
I'm not gonna sing it for everybody, but I will definitely. I'll put up some links to it because maybe I'll even just do this myself. I'll go in and get all the shots of Michelle building that mosaic of Mentos and play the Mentos theme song over it. Although that is a little mean.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll appreciate that when they find it.
Yeah, so we have a few more general questions. Ruloville says, Suki and Jinder's unintentional humor is really fun to watch. I want them to last to the end, but not win. Do you have any teams that you've felt that way about? Like, you want them to last forever, but you don't necessarily want to see them win?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some off the top of my head. Maybe Art and JJ. I'd liked having them in there, even though I really didn't like them. Brendan and Rachel, maybe?
Yeah, I'd absolutely. Brendan and Rachel would be my pick, because I definitely want to see them do what they do, but I don't know that I necessarily think that they're winner material.
No, and thankfully we got to see them all the way to the end twice and not win.
Yep. That's exactly how it should be. Yeah. So Mike Bloom had a good question too, which kind of leads us nicely into our discussion of Amazing Race Australia. He says, do you find it weird that the strong male villains thrived this week in Australia but got their comeuppance in Canada?
Well, it's an interesting contrast. I don't know how much they have to do with each other. I don't know.
There were some parallels. I definitely saw parallels, and I definitely think that John and Murray have to be heading for a fall.
Yeah, I can't imagine they're able to keep up this first, second all the time for that much longer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's working all right for Megan and Natalie, but...
Yeah, well, they still had their hockey-related fall all the way to fifth, but...
That's true.
Maybe that's enough to keep them up there.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I would say there are some really interesting parallels. Like, you have some teams getting hopelessly lost, thanks to terrible cab drivers. You have the kind of strong male villain teams taking a central role. You have kind of a surprising elimination of a really strong team. So there are some valid parallels, I would say.
Yeah, I can definitely see them.
Yeah. So the teams this week on Amazing Race Australia, they gave us a double episode, and my impression of this, and it's similar to what they're doing with another show here in the States, is they're going to be doubling up the episodes just to try to burn them off so they can move on to something else. My understanding is that the show is not doing as well as they wanted it to do, which that blows my mind because Amazing Race Australia is far and away the best iteration of the series. And that it's not a monster hit, that kind of surprises me.
Yeah, it's really surprising. Well, the second season did decrease in ratings from the first one, and I think a large problem is they had the year break where they didn't create the show so that they could try and revive the Mole Australia, and that didn't do well either. So I don't think they had the momentum going into this because they were advertising it, but they didn't tell us when it was on.
Is that common? Like, that's the thing I wonder about. Is that something that Australian TV does often? Do they just not tell you when things are going to be on?
I actually think it is. There are a lot of shows in Australia that you hear about, you hear about, you hear about, and you're like, oh, wow, it's on? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And also, the shows, even when you know what day they're on, it seems like they don't start when you think they're going to start.
No, that's one of the most annoying things about Australian television. Things don't start on, like, the hour or the half hour. They start when the networks want them to start, which is oftentimes at weird times, like 9:45 or 8:53.
Yeah. Now, Amazing Race US viewers do have some experience with that, because typically when, for many years, Amazing Race has been on Sunday nights, and there's usually a sporting event on in the early evening. Like, one week it was golf, usually it's football, sometimes it's NCAA basketball, and we often have to watch Twitter because they will tell us what time it's going to be on. But just having that be a general matter of course, that just boggles my mind.
Yeah, I really want it to be something that changes soon. And another thing that's weird is Australian television isn't always the same length. It's like how versions of the American show are always like 42 minutes, and that's how they are. But Australian shows, they can go from anywhere from like 45 minutes to an hour and a half, and you won't know.
Yeah, I noticed that about the previous seasons of the Australian show, where I would think, wow, they're really packing a lot of action into this hour. Oh, wait, it's not an hour, it's 90 minutes.
Yeah, that's one of the few things that annoys me about the Australian version. I really think they need to learn how to edit to a time limit and stick to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely, you lose some consistency if you're not beholden to that time limit.
Yeah.
Even if it's nice to have that little bit of extra footage.
Yeah, it's nice, but that's what web extras are for.
Exactly. And we get our fair share from here. Like, I'm enjoying the web extra content this season. So, teams are flying to Windhoek, Namibia, which is a destination that several iterations of The Amazing Race have been to before, but always kind of a fun one. I like it when they bring the teams to Africa. It's a lot of culture shock, and especially compared to the big cities they've been in thus far, this is a fun change of pace.
Yeah, it's always fun when they go to Africa. It's fun seeing the animals. It's fun seeing the teams interact with a culture that they're not familiar with or that they haven't really had a chance to learn about before.
Yeah, and I have to say they definitely responded to it, all of them, with a lot of grace. And we have had some American teams that have not done so well.
No, there are definitely some teams that do object. I was actually expecting Ashley and Jared to object to it, but they were quite happy about it.
Yeah, they seemed really game. I was very surprised as well. Because if anybody was going to pull that sort of Freddie and Kendra thing, it was going to be them, and they didn't.
Yeah, Ashley and Jared are this thing in In Australia, we'd probably call them bogans. Have you ever heard that term before?
I have heard that term, but mostly just in conjunction with Jared is a bogan. So enlighten me on what is a bogan.
Well, I tried to look it up beforehand, and the internet isn't very helpful in finding a specific definition, but I would describe it as sort of classless, trashy people. Like, they're sort of the equivalent of white trash in America, I think.
Sort of like rednecks is what we might call them.
Rednecks probably are probably what you're going to get in Tasmania. Because, like, bogans can be, like, bogans can have money. Like, mm-hmm. I think Ashley and Jared have money.
Yeah, they seem fairly well off and educated.
Yeah, so, it's just this idea of, like, they have this... A bogan is stereotypically someone who is very aggressive to other people. They're not particularly fond of other races, though I'm not... I don't think that's necessarily what Ashley and Jared are. And they're known for being kind of close-minded, I guess.
Yeah. And I think you see that a little bit in them being so adamant that they want Australia to win, even if it's not them. And very much national pride in a way that is kind of surprising to see coming from someone who's not American.
No. And to be honest, Ashley and Jared are probably more the exception than the rule in Australia. Like, there are definitely people that are proud to be Australian in a very aggressive way, like they are. But I would say that a lot of people would just find Ashley and Jared embarrassing. Like, we have this television show called Reality Check, and they featured Ashley and Jared this week, and the audience just laughed at how weirdly, obsessively they were with Australians winning.
Yeah, I do get the sense that they are mostly played for laughs, given that Jared got his own promo clip before the show even started that was just a supercut of him saying bloody over and over again.
Yeah, that's very stereotypical, like, Australian thing to say, I guess.
Yeah, so what did you make of the whole, like, premise of the season, the Australia versus New Zealand?
Like, it's good that they're able to get New Zealanders in there. Like, that's great for them. It's a interesting hook. Like, I guess people do care about this rivalry, but it's not serious. Like, as you can see on the show, like, most people don't care that much about it other than John and Murray and Ashley and Jared.
Yeah, my guess was that it was going to start out, they were going to try to make it a thing, and then as time went on, the barriers would kind of break down, and that's something I think we've seen play out, especially this week.
Definitely in the second of the two episodes.
Yeah. You have some alliances kind of being broken down and other ones being made, and it's starting to matter a little bit less which country you came from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, my first thought at the beginning of this episode, we see Daniel and Ryan taking off in second place, and my first thought was, they're running a really solid race. They haven't made a single error. I think they might be dark horses to win. Because you kind of have the whirlwind of chaos that is John and Murray, and you have some other teams that are a little bit more vocal, but then you have Daniel and Ryan who are just steady and great, and that lasted all of 10 minutes into this episode.
Yes, because soon after they left, you get the foreshadowing of, we've never really been in the back, so we don't know what that's like.
Yeah, and they are about to find out in a big way.
Yeah.
They see a sign. They're right behind Tyson and Sally. You see Tyson and Sally see the sign pointing to the university. They do a U-turn, and Ryan and Daniel do not make that turn. And it goes very badly.
They make a Mickey and Pete-esque detour.
Yes. We get to see some of the scenery of beautiful Namibia, which, you know, we will give them that. They go all the way back into Windhoek proper.
We get to meet some interesting locals.
Yeah, we get to meet a guy with a Kiwi sticker on his car, which, you know, kind of indicative of how the divide is breaking down.
Yeah, we also get to meet a guy who leaves his wife in the middle of nowhere so that he can help them find the university.
Now, some people will do anything to get on TV, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So, the first task on this, they are going to go to a wildlife sanctuary, and the route marker is one of the cuter route markers that we've seen in quite a while. They have these baby baboons, and they're going to escort them down a path to, I guess, the other baboon habitat or what have you. Like, is a bamboo walk, maybe that's a thing you do when you visit the wildlife sanctuary. I'm not sure.
I was very amused watching Grant with the baboons.
Yeah, Grant with the baboons, like, a lot of people really kind of bonded with their baboons, and they were really into it. Grant was not having any of it.
I feel as if the producers tried to put Grant in a bunch of situations to make him show emotion, and they didn't work. They put him with the baboons, he was as stone-faced as ever, they had him throw meat to the lions, and he didn't react, and they had him with the children, and he seemed just as uninterested.
Yeah, I mean, he is definitely, like, especially when you're comparing him to John Montgomery, who basically describes the task and then does it. Like, this, I think he almost looks worse next to John Montgomery.
Oh, he definitely looks worse next to John Montgomery.
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting a lot of flack from people on Twitter, because every time we play Ding, Marry, Kill and Grant Bowler is involved, I end up killing him.
Well, a lot of Australians are quite fond of Grant because of the fact that he used to host The Mole. So, I'd say he was definitely more emotive in that.
Yeah, I guess it would probably be the equivalent of, like, if we had our original Mole host, who was Anderson Cooper, if we got him hosting The Amazing Race US, he'd be as beloved as Phil.
Yeah. The other thing is, I feel as if before in The Mole was before he tried his career in America, and now The Amazing Race is after that, and he's realized it's probably not going to work out.
Yeah, and he made some questionable acting choices.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what starring opposite Lindsay Lohan is going to do for him.
Yeah, it's just going to make him a punchline over and over, and he's probably going to lose a lot more rounds of Ding, Marry, Kill.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, between that and the Atlas Shrugged movie, like, Grant Bowler is not winning any Academy Awards anytime soon.
What is Atlas Shrugged?
Atlas Shrugged, here in the U.S., we have, there's a philosophy called objectivism that is basically unrestricted capitalism and the virtue of selfishness. And it was this author, Ayn Rand, wrote a bunch of books about this and kind of does this straw man socialism thing where, like, anybody that does anything for anybody else is a bad person. And they made a movie out of this recently. A director got the rights to make the movie and decided to put himself in it as the main guy, and the other main guy was played by Grant Bowler. Opposite Taylor Schilling from Orange is the New Black was the female lead. And I did not watch it, but the book was pretty bad, and I'm pretty sure this movie's going to be worse.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's basically on the level of playing Richard Burton opposite Lindsay Lohan as Elizabeth Taylor. I'm not sure which was the worst decision he made, but if his inability to act happy when baboons are climbing on him is any indication, I'm going to say he probably didn't really nail it in either one of those cases either.
Hey, he got in Lost at least.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
He'll forever be able to remember that happy time in his life.
Yeah. So I liked that Jared did not know what a baboon was.
I liked that Sally didn't know that Namibia was definitely in Africa.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that as well. But, you know, it's a horizon-expanding show.
Yeah.
So the baboons tend to really like the ladies.
Yes, baboons apparently really like women. And this makes Jared jealous of the baboons that are hanging over Ashley.
Yeah, and the baboon tries to climb on him, maybe sensing that he feels left out. He doesn't let it. And
yeah, well, that's his loss.
Yeah, you know, this is you know, a culture-expanding experience here, and you're ruining it, Jared.
Yeah.
Just sometimes you gotta let the baboon climb on you. We also get a really inappropriate comment from Jono, shocker, about the baboon being impressed with certain attributes of Emily's. It's like, dude, why are you talking about your sister like that? You're not making us less likely to make jokes about it.
Yeah, Jono and Emily are the kinds of people that I imagine Tasmania has a reputation, and Jono and Emily are the kinds of people you'd imagine living here.
Well, what you said about rednecks before, I don't know, that's a, it's a connection I'm drawing here that maybe I don't want to make, but I see Jono and Emily as being one of those families that has, like, family game night, and they're just, like, weirdly all best friends with each other. I would say maybe even similar to what I imagine Suki and Jinder's home life must be.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, going quickly back to the preview for Tar Canada, that life modeling thing, they're weirdly happy about it.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that's actually, I'm looking very much forward to that, given how much fun it was when it was a fast forward in Amazing Race Australia 2.
Yeah. Still, I can't imagine doing it with a sibling.
No. No. But, again, you also had the thing in Turkey in Amazing Race Australia 2, which I think is the number one thing you don't want to have to do with a sibling, is lather them up with soap.
No, you don't want to lather your siblings up, and you don't, especially, you probably don't want to do it to your father either.
No, you definitely don't. Yeah, I admire Amazing Race Australia's dedication to pushing the envelope here. So, there's no skill associated with the baboon carrying, according to John. And this makes Jono really irritated. I think Jono at this point is kind of looking for excuses to get irritating with the rugby players.
And yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of Jono Murray, but I feel as if Jono was just already didn't like them and was just finding excuses to pick fights.
Yeah, they were really just kind of spoiling for a confrontation here. And at this point, you hear John saying to Jono, "I'm going to drop you." He says it a couple of times, and there is no actual dropping of anybody. I think if anybody drops Jono, it's the elements.
Yeah. He doesn't make some smart decisions.
No. It's not Jono's finest hour today. Or finest 8 hours, or however long he was out there. But at this point, we were led to believe in the previews that there was going to be some kind of physical altercation, and instead we get a juxtaposition of Jono getting threatened by John, and then Jono falling over in a totally separate incident, which, creative editing, kudos to the editors on that one, because I was almost fooled.
What do you think about it compared to the unfilmed shove from The Amazing Race Australia 2?
Oh, the shove. I want to believe if they don't have it on film, it didn't happen. I think it's really easy for people to kind of bring up things like that, and we had something similar happen on the most recent edition of the US version as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think very rarely people know that the second they lay a hand on another racer in an aggressive manner, I think everybody knows that's the second they get cut from the show and kicked off of the race, and nobody wants that. Nobody's going to risk that, like, not even if somebody is really, really terrible, and neither one of these teams is really terrible.
No, they definitely get aggressive and angry with one another, but I don't think they'd ever reach that point.
Yeah. I think some of it is, you know, the good old psychological warfare, which it's been suggested to me that this is the new drinking game.
John and Murray really seem to enjoy that turn of phrase.
Yeah, and they're about as good at it as Pierre and Michelle. Like, nothing they do tends to really mess with people that much.
Yeah, they're doing more than they have to.
Yeah. I think that's gonna come back to bite them. It's going to be similar to John and Jessica, I think. Like, John and Jessica was very much in this vein of, I'm going to think of the ways to be the best strategic mastermind and be the evil villain, and it just never comes to fruition. Like, you got to just sort of run your race first, and anything else should take a very distant second.
Yeah, just progressing through the race is more important. Making alliances is okay, but generally that won't affect you outside of U-turns.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's not enough strategy to make that be a huge factor. And even as much as they try to put that in there, it's not fundamentally a part of the race.
No.
So Daniel and Ryan, meanwhile, like halfway to Angola, they are at least an hour out of the race, and they invoke my favorite rule of the Amazing Race, which is never work with children or animals. And they are going to have a little bit of both this leg.
Yeah, that's... The children are probably more agreeable than the animals.
Yeah, that's true. And nobody was really... I think the bigger obstacles this leg had more to do with the elements and the difficulty of the tasks, because nothing that they had to do this leg was particularly easy, even if it was just a psychological break you had to get past. So
this roadblock is very difficult.
Yeah, this roadblock is... Not only is it difficult, it's gross, which makes for the best TV. So in this roadblock, they got to make buckets of lion feed and get the correct portions of ribs and innards. And people were pretty particular, but I noticed that everybody was allowed to say, well, what part of it did I do right and what part did I do wrong, which was interesting to me.
Yeah, it's not always... There are some task judges that will tell you that, but I think most of the time they won't.
Yeah. I think it depends on... There's another component of this task that's actually even harder than collecting your bucket of innards.
So, yeah, they sort of implied that the main part of the task was the cutting up and organizing the food, but I'd argue that the second part was much more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, and we see Jono is trying to take over the lead, and he starts kicking it into high gear. And I thought this was really interesting, John and Murray's reaction to this. They're not perturbed by it at all, because they think, like athletes, they think it's just a game, and like they'll all be friends afterwards. But Jono doesn't see it that way at all. Like, he takes it very, very personally.
Yeah, I can understand being a little bit defensive of a sibling, but I think Jono takes it a little bit too far.
Yeah, and especially you see this immediately as they're doing the task. As soon as Jono starts to get a little dehydrated and passes out in the middle of the path, the person who comes to his aid is John.
Like, yeah, and Jono sort of implies that John was only doing it out of obligation to not look like a terrible person. I don't think John is a terrible person who would just run right past Jono despite being passed out on the ground from heat exhaustion.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think he was doing the human thing. And it was really... Like, there was no way he was not going to do that. And I think it just was an interesting juxtaposition right after they said, you know, we'll all be mates afterwards, we'll have a drink off the field. And it just points out the difference. Like, here's doing the human thing and here's doing the race thing. And the second that Jono gets back up, he sprints past John, totally disregards everything that just happened.
I want to bait Johnny. I want to mess Johnny up.
Yeah. And John is still pep-talking him through all of this. He's like, you know, you can do it. Just take it easy. You know, small steps, baby steps. We'll get to the lions together. They're almost corroborating on this, like, against Jono's will, of course. But John is happy to get him through the task.
Yeah, because I don't think anyone wants to see someone die on the race or
no.
get significantly hurt. So it's just a human thing to want to help someone who's that in trouble at the time.
Yeah, and I think he came off very well through all this, John did. But I was really concerned that as Jono got worse and worse over the course of the episode, he was never shown drinking any water.
I thought he was given water when they got back from wheelbarrowing, but I think that might have been the only time.
Yeah, that was... And I think they had a bottle of water in the donkey cart, but he wasn't drinking it.
Yeah, that was strange.
Yeah. Yeah, so everybody else kind of gets through the task with not a lot of incidents. Carla does the cutting up incorrectly the first time around, and so she says this is the time we need to use the express pass. I think that was absolutely valid.
Yeah, that was a smart decision. Like, she spilt the innards all over her clue and made it illegible, so I think at that point, using the express pass was definitely the right decision.
Yeah, and illegible clues, as you will see in a minute, tend to be a difficult thing on this particular episode, because Jono's clue, in between all the blacking out and the sweating and falling over, his clue is so damaged he can't read it, and he starts to second-guess himself as to what he's supposed to do with regard to feeding the lions.
Yeah. Number one race rule, always read the clue. Number two race rule, don't ruin your clue.
Yeah, don't lose your clue. Don't let anything happen to it.
Yeah.
And then he does something that I think in his head is a strategic piece of genius, but...
I didn't understand trying to imply it was for Ashley and... for Jared and Tyson's benefits. I think he should have just came out and said, asked, and he might have got a better response.
Yeah, it was really transparent. Although I think his bigger error was he shouldn't have gone to Jared first. He should have
That's
gone
true.
To Tyson. I think Tyson might have bought it. And even if he didn't buy it, he would have just shown him the clue out of the goodness of his heart. But after he sees this whole thing go down with Jared, he's not inclined to help either.
No.
Yeah. So I didn't think that made a whole lot of sense, and I'm not surprised it didn't work for him. But I didn't really get a sense of what exactly he did, and a lot of people were confused about this, I think. Like, Christian Zicardo asked us on Twitter, did you notice that Jono still had food on his way back and no one else did? Did he have to go back and it just got cut out? Like, did you get what was going
yeah,
on there?
I did notice that, and I wasn't quite sure. Maybe they actually were going to receive a penalty for it, but because they were already last, it didn't matter.
Yeah, that's possible, because the editing in this was a little bit sketchy, like, all through the episode. I didn't have a good sense of how far behind they ended up being.
No, it was a bit everywhere, the editing for this particular episode.
Yeah, it was not their finest hour. But Daniel and Ryan have recovered from their scenic detour, and they've caught up fairly quickly because everybody else is taking forever at the roadblock, and they tend to have great strategy, so they figure it out quickly.
Yeah, I don't know how much being an ICU nurse helps, but I'm sure it was helpful in figuring out how to correctly chop up body parts.
Yeah, they said necrotizing fasciitis is way worse.
I don't even know what that is.
So that's your lesson. but I don't exactly know what it is either, but it's probably pretty dire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mike Bloom asked us, do you think production would have stepped in if Jono had really passed out from heat exhaustion?
I think so, and I feel if they did, they might have automatically disqualified him and Emily from the race.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, medical seems to step in when somebody ends up being seriously hurt, and sometimes it means they have to drop out and sometimes it doesn't. Like, it's hard to tell. Like, back in the day on Survivor, when people got really dehydrated, they just, like, plug an IV into them for a while. But I think they become less and less inclined to make sure everybody stays in as long as possible. And I do think they would have made sure he didn't die. Nobody wants that.
No, I don't think they want a repeat of Survivor France.
No. Or Survivor Bulgaria, for that matter. Yeah, you don't really see them letting people just be horribly ill. And in fact, somebody did pass out from heat exhaustion on The Amazing Race US. It was in season 14, I believe. Could have been 14 or 18, I can't remember. But Margie of Margie and Luke passed out on the mat. And
yeah, I feel as if that might have been a bit different because it was on the mat, so the leg was over and they could have them recover, like, as opposed to in the middle of the leg where it's obviously producer interference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think production wants to be as hands-off as possible, but they also don't want anybody to die.
Yeah.
So, then John ends up kind of, I think maybe he got a little psychological warfare himself, because he ends up going off on the wrong path on his way back from the Lions, and almost everyone ends up passing them, but finally he finds Jared, and Jared tells him where to go.
It seems like he came in from a different direction. Like, he came in the direction that everyone else was leaving via the donkeys.
Yeah, I don't think they lost a ton of time, but he lost enough to make a difference in their placement.
Yeah.
So, the next route marker, I thought this was brilliant. This is a brilliant use of a random little task, where you really don't necessarily have something that's going to be difficult, that's going to trip you up, or something that's going to make a difference in your race, but it is a chance to showcase the local culture in a way that I think Amazing Race US could take some lessons from.
Yeah, it was really fun. Like, it gave the teams time to, like, sort of relax a little bit, because it's not that stressful a task, and it allows them to be a little bit more human interacting with these children.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was a little bit difficult, but they also weren't going to judge them harshly on their song singing. It's just like, this is a fun moment.
The only judges are the children, I guess.
Yeah, the children aren't going to just randomly be dicks.
No, they're not going to be like the yes-no guy in the next part.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about the yes-no guy. Yeah, so there's a lot of people like passing each other and switching up the order as this is going on, and they get to the detour, and they gotta travel by donkey cart to the Bushman village, and this is maybe one of the grosser detour options I've ever seen. My note here as a describing the different tasks, I have pipe, it says start a fire like on Survivor so the chief can light his pipe, and then under poo I just have what.
Hey, you wouldn't get Phil or John saying poo.
Yeah, you wouldn't get him saying poo, but I think John would probably just do the task in front of you to demonstrate it.
Yeah, you'd get that bonus at least.
Yeah, but clearly the quicker choice was the grosser one, and it has the bonus of being judged by really adorable children. But 8 meters seems like a really long way to have to spit something.
Yeah, 8 meters is really far, actually. I didn't catch the length.
Yeah, like how airborne is a little piece of dried bok poo?
What is bok poo? What is bok?
Bok is like an antelope.
Oh, okay.
So they're like little antelope pellets. And I imagine they're dried out, so it's not like you're putting fresh poo in your mouth. Like, there's no E. coli danger here.
I can't imagine fresh poo is very aerodynamic.
No, definitely not. Yeah, but almost everyone gets it pretty quickly.
Yeah, even the teams that take a little bit of time, like Carla and Hedony, they still finish it quickly enough. I can't imagine it taking longer than maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. And we haven't talked much about Jesse and Kat, but I thought Jesse had the... If Amazing Race Australia were titling their episodes the same way that US and Canada do, I think he would have gotten the title this week with his line, "I smell like crap, I might as well taste like it."
I thought you were going to bring up when Kat was spitting out the poo, and Jesse says, "Spit it like you love it."
That's a pretty good one as well. And I wonder what the danger is. Like, I know you have to kind of work up some, you know, some torque on this before you spit it. Like, what is the danger that you're going to suck it in too hard and swallow it?
Well, later on, when Sally, the lightning strike happens, when Sally succeeds, you can see Tyson next to her, and it looks like he's eating them.
That can't be right. I mean, I know the guy needs a lot of calories to get through his day, but there's got to be a better explanation.
Yeah, it could be anything else, but I like to think that he was eating them, because that was the only thing I could see.
Yeah, I like that explanation as well. I'll go with it. But yeah, Kat and Jesse totally nailed it. Carla and Harony got it pretty quickly. Sally had a little bit of trouble, but she got there.
And the lightning struck in the background at the same time.
Yep, which was beautiful. You can't even plan those things.
But no.
Jono and Emily can't do it, so they decide to go to the fire. And it turns out starting a fire, not that easy either.
No, apparently starting a fire is the same in Namibia as it is in Botswana.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, nobody had any luck with that in Botswana. And this is almost the same thing, but I would think it's not as big a deal as going on Survivor, but if you're going on any reality show, you should probably be okay at starting a fire. Like, maybe you get a pass if you're going on Big Brother, but definitely Survivor, Amazing Race, learn how to make a fire without matches.
Yeah, fire is like a basic reality show skill.
Yeah. Now, something I noticed here is that Emily really seemed to not be pulling her weight on this task. Like, she was letting Jono do it, and he just kept falling over.
Yeah, maybe they thought that Jono would have the upper body strength to sort of push the stick in and start an ember, but I feel as if Emily could have at least given it a try.
Yeah, I mean, she gave it kind of a half-hearted try after Jono fell over, but it really ended up being him that did most of the work on this, and I was feeling pretty bad for the guy by the time he gets to the end.
Yeah, I must admit, I laughed when he was running with his cramped legs.
Yes.
But I definitely felt bad for them, and they were definitely surprised that they ended up being eliminated.
Yeah. Well, we got a question from John Johnston, who always tweets me a lot of questions, but he pointed out something that I saw that really puzzled me. It showed Emily and Jono getting ready to finish up their task and head to the mat, and then it cuts to Ryan and Daniel, and it says that they're in last place, but they're both coming from roughly the same direction to the mat, and you don't see them pass Emily and Jono. You don't even see them in the same frame, and I wonder, were they really in last place, or was that editing totally lying to us?
Yeah, it's either creative editing, or the places were further apart than we thought, but I think it's probably the former.
Yeah, because my sense of it is by that point they were basically dead on their feet and everybody else had passed them. But they definitely played a little more dramatic than that.
Yeah.
And you always have that team where they start out very strong and you think they're going to be one of the forces at the end, and they end up going out fairly early. And on this season, Emily and Jono, I think, were that team.
Yeah, like last the Amazing Race Australia, it was Sticky and Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, same thing. Or like Rob and Amber in the first All-Stars.
Yeah.
You think they're going to go all the way, and something pretty shocking happens. John and Jessica, their first time out, same thing. So, yeah, it was a little surprising. I thought they were going to go much further than that, but they also didn't seem to be very concerned with self-care.
No, I get the sense that they really wanted to be on the race, but they probably didn't prepare for it as well as they could have.
Yeah, I think they may have assumed, like, we're young, we're in good health, we'll be fine, and just kind of ran up against some elements that were a little bit more intense than they thought.
Yeah, like, Jesse, who is not, he's less fit than ideal, but he still managed to get through the leg without passing out.
Yeah.
So it's anyone can, I'd argue that anyone can really do the race. It's just a matter of how well prepared you are for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even like, you don't even necessarily have to be prepared if you know how to react to things the right way. Like,
yeah.
I would say Daniel and Ryan are in a really great position, even with getting lost, because they are able to take anything that comes at them.
Yeah, that, like Mickey and Pete, they have a really positive attitude. They're not going to, even when they were in last place and the baboon wasn't listening to them, they kept their happy attitudes around. So that always helps.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the biggest takeaway from this episode is, if you're going to the desert, drink a lot of frickin' water. Drink more than you think you need. Like, this is
water
a public service. Public service message. Yeah. So I was also kind of surprised that Emily and Jono seemed so surprised that they were out.
I imagine they thought that Daniel and Ryan were further behind. I don't think they saw them.
Yeah, I don't think they did either. And I think maybe it was just because they were over at the fire challenge while everybody else did the poo. So they didn't have a sense of it, I guess, similar to Rex and Bob a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, the curse of seventh place.
Yep. Indeed. But it does, we gotta close the book on Emily and Jono, and close the book on this leg, and then we go somewhere remarkably different in this next leg coming up. We're gonna go to a classic Amazing Race destination, St. Petersburg, Russia, where fortunately nobody has to eat 2 pounds of caviar.
I really like how every single leg has been in a different country so far.
Yeah, especially coming off of such a terrible American season,
yeah,
where they were 2 legs per country and not a lot of moving around and not a lot of culture. They really have gone all out with the race course so far. And
this is more countries than in the first 8 legs of the last American season.
Yeah. Yeah, they give a lot more thought to it, I think, in Australia.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons that they are far and away the best version of the show. Like, if they had the people that worked on the Australian one, if they were doing the American race, it would be the number one show on television here in the States.
And maybe it wouldn't be on Friday nights.
Maybe it wouldn't be in the Friday night death slot. Like, I'm seeing my tenure as Amazing Race podcaster kind of winding down after next season, but they have a good cast, so we'll see. But anyway. Anyway, the first task, they got to find a battleship. And everybody gets on 3 different flights, which is another thing that was missing from Amazing Race US last season. There wasn't really opportunity to kind of do some airport jiggering, and so that was another element that I missed a lot, and I'm happy to see it here.
I like the comparison between Ashley and Jared and Daniel and Ryan's perspective on Russia. Jared says Russia is not a country you think about going to yourself, and Daniel and Ryan say Russia is bucket list stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the difference between them, I guess.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of great little character moments there. Like, we get Kat and Jesse sort of tearing down the wall between Australia and New Zealand. They said they're not really on the side of the Kiwis. They're not really on the side of the Aussies. They're kind of friends with everyone, so they call themselves the Anzacs, which I thought was very cute.
Do you know what they are?
What are they?
The Anzacs.
Yeah.
Anzac stands for... Oh, okay.
I know what they are, but I think people are... Some of our listeners may not, so why don't you recap that for us?
Okay, the ANZAC stands for Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, which is sort of this group of Australian New Zealand Army that went to Gallipoli during the First World War to fight.
Yeah, and they have a day in March.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Well, they do.
Yes. Well, they do, and you celebrate it.
Yes.
Yeah.
We celebrate it with barbecues and... I'm not going to say shrimp on the barbie, prawn on the barbie.
Does anybody say shrimp in Australia?
I think some people do. I think shrimp and prawn are different things in Australia. Like, we treat them as different things.
Okay. All right. If someone wants to clarify that for me, I don't know the difference between shrimp and prawns. They all seem kind of like they're crustaceans to me.
No, I think that they're the same thing to me, I think.
Yeah. So, on Anzac Day, you have barbecues and special desserts, and it's a good time all around. And someone that bridges the gap between the two nations, it's a great name for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we get some airport kind of colluding, and Carla and Harony give John and Murray info about this great flight they found, which is interesting, and it's gonna come back to bite them a little bit.
Yeah. Carla and Harony, I thought, were a little bit like Megan and Natalie in this point, trusting the sort of untrustworthy game body team.
Yeah, I think that's a very good parallel. So all the flights are about 30 minutes apart, which I think is fair. I hate it when they're like 3 hours apart. So this is good.
It's amazing that they were able to get 3 different flights that close together.
Yeah, well, St. Petersburg is kind of a major hub, and they have a lot of connecting flights that they can take. So that didn't surprise me terribly much. The ones that surprised me were when they were landing, like, 5 minutes apart.
Yeah, that's true.
Or they had one, I think, I can't remember where they landed, that they landed, like, at the same time. How does that even work?
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. So, one thing I noticed when John and Murray get into their cab, John's really got a great ear for language. And I noticed this last week, he was speaking Thai to the driver, and here he's, like, got a few words of Russian, and I have to think that's because he's very well-traveled, but I think it's impressive all the same. Like, you don't see that level of language learning with most people.
Yeah, language skills is sort of underappreciated skill on The Amazing Race, because they tend not to show the teams speaking in the native language.
Yeah, or they have one contestant who is fluent in one language, and it becomes a minor plot point. But yeah. you don't see someone making that much of an effort to learn more than, like, hello and fast and thank you. But John does that. He knows quite a bit more than you would guess. So I gotta give him props for that.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect it from... You'd probably stereotype him as not the kind of person to do that, so it's impressive that he's able to remember things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they have smarts. They just don't always apply them the right way. So, Carla and Harrity make a crucial error here. They forget to pick up their clue, and they just start doing the roadblock together, which I'm surprised they didn't get a penalty for that.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised. Well, we haven't seen the end of the leg yet, actually.
That's true. Maybe they did. Or maybe you don't get a penalty on a to-be-continued leg. Spoilers.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But John and Murray prove that you shouldn't help John and Murray because they're not at all helpful.
No. I'm kind of surprised they didn't help them because it's such a minor thing and it's just going to create animosity towards them.
Yeah, but again, they're the Pierre and Michelle of this race. They don't really take that into account. They just think they're looking out for number one, and they don't have to worry about these things.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's just a simple matter of not being a dick for 3 minutes, like, do it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not gonna destroy your chances of winning the race.
It's not going to impact their theory that by interacting with other teams, they're going to ruin their teamwork.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that off of the race, like, just by on terms of sheer personality and not taking into account anything they have done as racers, I think John and Murray are adorable. They're really fun. And you get glimpses of this every so often. Like, you get Murray doing this roadblock and going off about the task judge giving him the old yes-no.
Yeah, they have a very... I get annoyed with them sometimes, but I quite enjoy their sense of humor.
Yeah, they are really, really funny.
Like when they do the dance later on, Murray refers to himself as a giant Tickle Me Elmo.
Yeah. Yeah, which is not entirely inaccurate. Yeah. So, what did you think of this roadblock? How does this rank as far as tough roadblock tasks?
This is definitely the easiest of the three we've talked about. It shouldn't take that long. It's a little... The most difficult thing is probably figuring out when it starts.
Mm-hmm.
But Cyrillic... They say Cyrillic is hard, or Russian, but it shouldn't be that hard to just write down the signs and then transpose that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think I was really impressed with Ryan's strategy on this, where everybody else was writing down, like, what position the guy's hands were in, and Ryan just drew the stick figures.
Yeah, I don't understand why more people didn't do that, because it's... to me, that seems like the obvious thing.
Yeah, these guys are really... Like, they're really sharp in that situation. I think maybe people were just kind of overthinking it. I'm not even sure.
Yeah.
But they end up kind of colluding with Carla and Harrity and, you know, crossing some international boundaries yet again.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And then when Carla and Harrity... When the two teams leave, Carla and Harrity wipe their board, and then Kat and Jesse complain about Team Kiwi being over.
Yeah, which... I put down they contemplated defecting to Australia. I don't know how easy that is to do, but they were... I mean, do you think they had a valid gripe here?
Again, it seems very minor. Like, it's... I don't have a problem with them complaining about this, but it's still a very small thing to overreact about.
Yeah. Yeah, and it reminded me a lot of Suki and Jinder being upset that nobody's telling them how to do things.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, but then we see Sally and Tyson kind of have two major moments of being way too nice, which they said that was going to be their shortcoming, and it absolutely has been so far.
I can definitely see the Jason and Amy comparisons that you've been making.
Yeah, as they go on, they're getting more Jason and Amy-esque. And
it reminds me a little bit of the taxi stealing reminds me a little bit of Austria with Tim and Ray.
Yeah. Yeah, it's similar to that, for sure.
I wonder if we'll see the equivalent of Providence Sally, I guess.
Providence Sally. Yeah, I could see it. But I think if anybody of those two is going to get upset with somebody, it's going to be her. But we see really should not have worked. They say they're going to give them a clue about the roadblock, and in return, they will get their cab.
I have no idea why they agreed to this.
This was a terrible idea. I don't understand. Because, like, clearly they want a taxi, so mm-hmm. that means that getting a taxi is hard.
Yeah.
And the clue that you got wasn't even that helpful.
Yeah, it was almost on par with the previous leg, Jono saying, I'm just trying to help you out. Like, no, you're not. You're trying to get ahead.
Yeah. But as transparent as they were being in how devious they were, Sally and Tyson are just nice people, so they let it go eventually.
Yeah, I think they might have realized it's not exactly worth being too terribly upset about. So what I do have to give them credit, they didn't seem to assume that cab was coming back.
Yeah, they knew that they'd have to go find another cab afterwards.
Yeah. So... And Sally's way too nice. She gives Jesse and Kat the board, and Kat gets the answer, and they move on to the detour. Cossack or coat rack?
Another detour task that we've seen before.
Definitely, we have seen that one before. And I don't mind it, because it's pretty great. It's two tasks that seem remarkably well-balanced.
Yeah, and... Well, the only unfortunate thing is that the outfits aren't so tight that they keep tearing, like what happened to Natalie.
Yeah, there is that. It's probably for the best. I'm not sure these are people that we want to see that happening to.
No.
Yeah, and especially given John and Murray are not very good at this to start out. And here's a little thing I noticed that I thought was hilarious. They try the dance the first time, and Murray's reaction is, the judge said no, no. I'm thinking, well, that's worse than a yes-no.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. And Murray also makes a really astute observation. He says, and he's joking a little bit, he says, I don't want to put myself in a position where I'm being judged. And he's kind of joking, but he's not wrong. It's harder when there's a very subjective task, and you don't know exactly how good you have to be at it. He's got a good point. But John is convinced that it's still going to take them less time than finding the coat rack.
I probably would agree that the dance is better, because the second detour has two parts to it. You have to sort out the tags, and then you have a needle in a haystack task of searching through the coats.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, but if you have a good strategy, I don't think it's gonna... I still think something where you know there's like a definite outcome... I don't know, it's hard, because learning a dance and needle in a haystack are, like, kind of the two worst.
Yeah.
But
or maybe singing.
Oh, I don't know. I give Tim a lot of crap for that. But I thought the singing was not... That was not going to kill anybody either.
Yeah.
So, Tyson and Sally choose coat rack, Ryan and Daniel choose coat rack, and Ryan and Daniel... show their analytical skills off again, and they say it's because they're nurses and they like to make order out of chaos, but however they did it, I thought their strategy was fantastic.
Yeah, I think they're relating it to their job, but I think they're just genuinely smart guys, and this was a very smart strategy of sorting them into the hundreds and then into the tens and then just counting them as opposed to putting them in order.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fantastic way of doing that. So, they get it pretty quickly, but while they're doing this, John and Murray are having trouble with the dance, so Murray insists that they try the coat rack. and they run through, and this was so Suki and Jinder-esque. They run through, they freak out, they run through the area, they run back, and it's a tornado of chaos. Exactly like Suki and Jinder.
I can understand getting annoyed that there weren't any tables free, but there's still the floor. They didn't really think that through.
Yeah, no, they could have absolutely done the floor, but they decide they're just going to stick with the dancing, and so they go back to that. And we continue to watch people go through the coat racks, which is not a fun task to watch. It's really less dynamic.
It was lucky that Daniel and Ryan managed to find it so quickly.
Yeah, I was surprised nobody ever found another team's number.
Or maybe if they did, they just didn't show it.
Yeah, maybe that's true. So Tyson and Sally also pick the coats. They're going to the coats. Tyson has to stop and pee. Apparently they didn't watch season 14.
No. I still don't understand why people still do this.
Yeah. Well, I'm told that the crew is allowed to take bathroom breaks whenever they want. And sometimes you just try to go when they go. But
well, that's a good... Yeah. That's probably a better strategy than doing it mid-detour.
Yeah. So nobody is going to be killed by this task. And we go to the intersection. Now, this is something that we've had a lot of on Amazing Race Australia, but we've not seen this on Amazing Race US in a lot of seasons. And so we have a lot of people asking us, why intersections? Like, what are they adding? What are they contributing? And what's your take on this? Do you like the intersection?
I'm not the biggest fan of the intersection. I like that it gives teams the opportunity to interact with each other in a different way than normal on the race, but I don't like how it forces teams to wait for another team, because that's not interesting to watch, and it often feels like the tasks don't need to be done in groups of four. Like, this one was just two people.
Yeah, this one was a route marker for sure.
Like, I guess the only reason I can think of for this task being an intersection is there was only one laser maze and they didn't want six groups of people lining up to do it.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah. So I liked the laser maze. I definitely thought that was a great aspect of it.
This is one of the coolest tasks I've ever seen on The Amazing Race. I would love to do this.
Yeah. They did something like this on King of the Nerds this past season as well. And it's just very fun to watch. And it looks like something out of a heist movie. And I even loved that if you tripped up the maze, if you touched one of the lasers, you would then get escorted out by security. That was fantastic.
I wish we got to see more of that.
Yeah, I don't know how many times. Maybe that was the only time it happened, but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of strategy involved with who you're going to pair up with. Nobody really wants to team up with John and Murray, but Daniel and Ryan finally suck it up and do it.
Ashley and Jared?
Oh, yeah, Ashley and Jared. You're right. Daniel and Ryan were saying they didn't want to, and they ended up getting lost, so it didn't matter.
I wonder if the other... Because the Australian teams apparently all said that they didn't want to team up with John and Murray. I wonder if this will come back and bite Ashley and Jared for their decision to team up with them, or if it will just get forgotten like Leon Jamal U-turning the Cowboys.
Yeah, it's definitely... It's interesting, especially because there's an Aussie-Kiwi divide there. And, like, yeah. Of all the people that are going to team up with a Kiwi team, Ashley and Jared are going to team up with the... you know, most annoying Kiwi team.
That was the most surprising thing to me. Like, they're always talking about this Australia-Kiwi divide and how they don't want the Kiwis to win, and yet they're helping put John and Murray in a position to win the leg, and they did.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's better than, like, making everybody wait and taking the risk that someone's going to show up and then not want to work with you.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Ashley and Jared definitely realize that it's better to not be last than to blow your chance at winning by taking a risk to come in first.
Yeah, it was a smart strategical decision as opposed to just letting their emotions get ahead of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, there's not much to say about the egg task except that it was cool to watch and it doesn't really mess with the order all that much. I liked seeing the teams interact a little bit, especially Johnny thinking that he's in charge of this, talking Ash through the whole thing, and she's just ignoring him.
The repeated saying of good girl was very patronizing.
Yeah, it's not doing him any favors. And I liked he had this sort of Indiana Jones moment where he thinks that they can't leave the marked area and they have to stand there to grab the egg. That was pretty hilarious, because I'm pretty sure that was not true.
No, it's another sign of them overthinking things.
Yeah. Yeah. So everybody gets through it. Jesse and Kat work with Carla and Herodine, and Jesse says, "We haven't seen them since Battleship Aurora," which sounds like a major incident now. But Carla's really helpful, and they forgive them, and that's great.
They forgive them for something they had to do together.
Yes. So it's nice to see them mending fences. I don't like it when there's like a season-long grudge.
No, I think it's much better than when they get along together.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you get your shocking moment. All we see is John and Murray hitting that mat and getting greeted by a lady in a Chewbacca costume, and... And Grant says to them, "You're not done racing." So
this was really strange to me. If I was programming this, I would have made the double episode next week.
Yeah, it is. It is and it isn't. Like, the double episode leaves you on a cliffhanger, which I kind of like. And I liked the juxtaposition of having two very different locations. But I see your point. Like, continuity-wise, it would have made more sense to have them... this be the special two-part episode.
Yeah.
I could see it either way. I liked having... It was almost like having three entirely different episodes this week. And I liked that a lot. I also like that next week we're going to get the Trans-Siberian Railway, which is something I am always intrigued by.
Yes, and we get to see... It looks like we're going to see another task that we've seen on the US version... And also that Grant mentions that one team's life is going to change forever, and then it has a close-up of Sally looking down at someone. So I feel as if we might get a repeat of what happened on The Amazing Race Canada this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could definitely see that. We could also see something like Eugenia and Joyce in the orphanage in Africa deciding that they might adopt children.
Yeah, we could also see that.
Yeah, so it's hard to tell, but they always tend to overplay these things. So
yeah, because we got a fight that didn't happen.
Yeah, we got a fight that was supposed to be John versus Jono and turned out to be Jono versus the elements.
Yeah,
and the elements won. So I got one final question here while we're wrapping things up. Michael Harmstone had to throw me a DMK because he thinks it's hilarious that I keep killing Grant Bowler. And so he says, "Sting, Mary, kill the baboons, the Mentos artists, or Grant Bowler."
Well, I'm not into bestiality, so I'll have to unfortunately kill the baboons. I don't want to spend the rest of my life with Grant. I guess I'll ding him, and then I'll marry the Mentos artist.
Okay, that's fair. I could ding the Mentos artist as well, but I could marry the baboons. It could be it could be free of conjugal relations, and then I could get to kill Grant Bowler again. So you don't win this one, Michael Harmstone, and apparently Grant Bowler doesn't either. So, George Wise, where can we find you on Twitter?
Well, I'm at GY64.
Okay, GY64. I am always at Haymaker Hattie, and you guys know me. I love to chat Amazing Race with you, so feel free to tweet me anytime. Subscribe on iTunes if you like what we're doing. You can find this on the Amazing Race main feed on Rob Has a Podcast. You can also find it under Reality Rehap Ups, where we cover a number of shows. Right now, we're also doing Bachelor in Paradise, which is hilarious. So make sure you tune in for all those things. There's a lot going on. Rob Has a website, so hit the website, see what you like to listen to. And if you like what you're hearing, come on iTunes and give us some reviews. If we get a lot of reviews, it boosts us, gets us a bigger audience, more interaction, better shows. So thank you very much, George. I'm glad to finally have an Aussie joining me. You're welcome back anytime. It was very fun.
Thank you. It was really fun to do this.
All right. So I will hopefully be back next week. Working out some logistical things. Have to find a co-host. But we will be covering the same great Amazing Race dual nation international content when I return. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Have a great night.